record on here. So, yeah, we're sort of sitting outside after a few hours after you've had your presentation. And can you tell me where you're from and why you're here?
Well, yeah, thanks very much indeed. My name's David Haslam. I'm from the United Kingdom, where I'm chairman of NICE, which is the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, which is the organisation that advises the UK health system about quality of care across a whole range of aspects. But I spent most of my life as a general practitioner in rural Cambridgeshire, and I've been a sort of a leader in general practice in the Royal College as well. So, and I'm here because I was asked.
And I mean, you had a brilliant reception to your presentation today, and I think it really resonated with a lot of people because they were drawn to what you were saying about the difficulties in general practice, and I suppose how to be a good doctor, which you outlined quite well. I think you had three criteria.
Well, I mean, did I have three criteria?
Well, was it care, listen.
Oh yeah, no, what I was talking about was some time ago. I was asked to make a video of how to consult, because there's lots of experts and gurus out there who've produced guidance on this. And I said I thought it was really very straightforward. All you had to do is shut up, listen, care, and know something. And I'm not being facetious by saying that. Said all the evidence is that if doctors shut up and listen, and if you listen for up to 2 minutes, the chances are you'll get to the heart of what your patient's bothered about. And the evidence suggests that most doctors in the UK and the US, at least, interrupt after about 14 seconds. Mm. So the patient started the story, and the doctor then starts to throw in the sort of little detailing questions that we've been trained to do. When actually, just shut up and listen. The story will come out. You'll find what's bothering your patient. And then when I talked about caring, what I'm talking about is just be interested in the person who's in front of you. I'm not talking psychobabble. I'm talking about just being interested. Mm. You know, like you and I sitting here together, sort of people relating to each other. It's just being interested in that. And knowing something, of course, is critical. I mean, that's the vital bit of our job, is what our patients expect from us. So there's nothing really difficult about this. And it's focusing on the real human being who's in front of you. And I think that's what resonated with people. They don't like medicine to become too overly technical. They want to return to the humanity, which is vital.
And it's quite interesting, I suppose, because your work is so heavily influenced by guidelines.
Yeah.
Or you're so involved in,
yes, absolutely,
in guidelines, to then take it back to those three criteria.
Well, that's right, but it's not an either-or. I mean, the guidelines, the simple fact is there's a vast amount of research going on into every possible aspect of healthcare, and you need, as a doctor, as a frontline doctor, you need to know what's best for your patient. What is the current management that's really most effective for whatever, hypertension, asthma, or whatever? Now, you've got a choice. You can either read all the research papers yourself, which, as I pointed out in my talk, is absolutely physically impossible, or you need an authoritative, trustable organization that does the reading and the synthesis for you. Now, having all that information, you then have to ally that with your own individual patient, and particularly around issues like multimorbidity, where patients may have multiple health problems. I talked about a patient of my own when I was in practice who had, if I can remember them, coronary artery disease and hypertension and hyperlipidemia and chronic kidney disease and macular degeneration and hip osteoarthritis and, hardly surprisingly, depression. Mm. That's only seven, and I know he had eight. Right, and what I say is that if you took the individual guidelines for all those conditions and added them together, that would create over-treatment, polypharmacy, probably drug interactions. So the responsibility of the doctor is to look at what the evidence is and then apply it to their patient, taking into account what matters to that patient.
I mean, that just seems to be the crux of probably the hardest thing.
Yeah,
in general practice, is, I mean, every combination must be different.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And NICE, in fact, has been looking at producing guidance on dealing with multimorbidity, but we've had to do it very generically because there must be an infinite number of possible combinations. Interestingly, certainly in the UK, there are more people with two or more long-term conditions than there are with just one long-term condition. So having just one condition, like hypertension, asthma, whatever, depression, is actually quite unusual. Most people have got something else as well. And the moment you've got something else, there's the potential for the treatments to get in each other's way. I mean, just a simple combination of chronic kidney disease and osteoarthritis, the drugs that you would use for either of those are hugely influenced by the other condition. So the skill of the doctor is knowing how to apply that. It's a hugely skillful job being a GP. I mean, that's one of the other things I talk about. It really is. It's a very difficult, highly skilled job, and GPs should be hugely proud of themselves for doing it.
I think you talked about the word just.
Yeah, oh boy, yeah.
I know it's a hated word. And
well, it's this extraordinary frustration that, you know, if you meet someone socially for the first time and they discover you're a doctor, they always say, so are you a specialist or just a GP? And it's just, you know, no just about it. I deal with anything and everything, you know, of every spectrum, of every age group. For me, it's complete mystery as to why the smaller your area of expertise, the higher your prestige. And it's not just in medicine, it's in the law, it's in everything. You know, so if you know everything about a tiny thing, you're seen as being, wow, that's really impressive. But a generalist, you know, anybody can do that. Rubbish. It's a highly skilled job.
Yeah, I think that you said something really interesting about, the cardiothoracic surgeon story.
Well, what it was, I mean, I quite often tell the story to audiences, and it's because I quite often talk to groups of medical students, and they often tell me that, you know, a consultant in their teaching hospital will say something like, you know, come on, you're not working very hard. If you don't start working harder, you risk ending up as a GP, which is such a terribly derogatory thing to say. And as I say, you can't imagine anybody saying, if you don't start working really hard, you risk ending up as a cardiothoracic surgeon. And of course, everybody laughs. But actually, it's really interesting. They don't laugh when it's general practice, because actually that's the way everybody accepts it. That it's a, you know, so we just, I'm trying to reclaim the high ground of, this is a very difficult specialty on an absolute par with any other. I mean, I didn't say this in my talk, but I know several of the more recent presidents of the Royal College of Surgeons in the UK. They all tell me the same thing. They could not cope with the risk involved in being a GP. They feel much safer as surgeons. Now, 99.9% of the public would think the risk was the other way around, that surgery is the risky one. But they are working, I mean, they're hugely skilled people. I'm not knocking them at all, but they're working in teams with protocols, with clear guidance, with, you know, in an entirely different environment, whereas the GP may be by him or herself faced with anything, making a decision as to is this headache the beginning of a subarachnoid hemorrhage, or are they just unhappy? That is a massively skillful.
It sort of comes back to what you were saying, I think, as well, about the guidelines and the fact that they are guidelines, and your organisation puts a disclaimer, don't you,
start. I mean, applied really simply, what I say is you should follow our guidelines unless there's a good reason not to. And there may be good reason not to, which include patient autonomy. The patient maybe doesn't want any more pills, thank you very much, doctor. Or it may be to do with multimorbidity. What isn't acceptable is saying, I don't believe in your guidelines. You know, I've got better ways of treating. I don't think there's any, you know, if people have got evidence that we're wrong, then show us. But for people just to carry on doing things the way they always have done, I don't think it's acceptable. But apply it to the individual patient. That's the critical bit.
And don't blindly follow.
And don't just
I think you said guidelines, not tramlines.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a clue in the word guideline.
Yeah. That is quite good, self-explanatory. Okay, well, look, I think we're about to get more people coming in, so I'll leave it there for now.
It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Does that work? Do you want to check, or do we have to do it all again? I'm used to this.
No. I think.